is without the support of Western governments, including the UK, a major supplier of weapons to Saudi Arabia.
Politicians pursue monetary and other personal interests, and in doing so, they overlook human rights abuses, even when it comes to matters which go against their own principles, such as freedom of speech and of expression.
To Abdullah and his fellow campaigners, the road to real reform in Saudi Arabia is a tedious one, but they say they won't relent. They say they're motivated by the words of Nelson Mandela. It always seems impossible until it's done. Saeed Purizza, London.
The President of the Shura Council and the Deputy Speaker of the House of Representatives in the Saudi-backed Hadi regime admitted that the regime has turned its back to Yemeni people and accused the Saudi-led coalition of causing a humanitarian crisis for the whole nation.
The statements by the officials in the Hadi regime clearly show that the war is not the solution to the current problem in Yemen, and the country needs a political solution. The statements also reveal the constructive role of the Ansarullah group in the fight against the Saudi-led coalition. There is a growing public call for an end to the war in Yemen.
The Deputy Minister of Information in Sana'a, Nasruddin Amir, said these statements came in the right direction, and Sana'a encourages taking such stances against the Saudi-led coalition, even if they do not have a direct impact on the battle.
We welcome any protests within the Saudi-led coalition. These protests show the true nature of the coalition and come in the right direction. We know that this is the U.S. who is leading the war on Yemen.
Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a deadly war on Yemen on March 2015 to return their protege, exiled former President Abdurrabbu Mansur Hadi, to power. The war has killed tens of thousands of civilians, most of them women and children, and pushed the country to the brink of famine.
For 7 years now, Saudi Arabia has failed to achieve any of its announced goals in the beginning of the war. Observers say Riyadh should start looking for other means, including a political solution, to get rid of the quagmire it's stuck with its war on Yemen, since the Yemeni army has proven that it is now a real threat to the kingdom more than ever. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
As the winter draws near, relief material starts pouring in for destitute Rohingya refugees in India. But urge for schooling and educational material for their children is their biggest worry. Despite the UN conventions on the rights of child, irrespective of nationality, faith or ethnicity, the majority of Rohingya children continue to be deprived of any formal education, therefore threatening their future.
We have faced all the odds and miseries of this world, but we appeal to the world community not to ignore our generations and do everything possible to help us educate our children.
Several thousand Rohingya Muslims have been camping in parts of India for more than a decade, with nothing more to share rather than horror tales of violent past. In almost all refugee camps, children would usually be seen spending time in dirt and filth, raising fears of disease and infections across the camps. Nevertheless, nobody cares, including them. This man says anxiously, "We will fight with life as long as we can, but the future worry of our children might kill us silently."
We have been living here in peace since the last 9 years, never faced any troubles. But now things look very challenging. India gave us hope of new life. We want to stay alive for our children, lest we have no hope left.
Regardless of refugee crisis the world has witnessed since last decade, this particular community continues to be unseen victims of violence, yet ignored or perhaps abandoned. Estimates suggest more than 40,000 Rohingya refugees live in India after fleeing a brutal crackdown in Myanmar. The UN refugee agency responsible to support them is of insignificant help, they say. Rights activists have time and again appealed to the Indian government to lend all possible support to the community, despite the fact they face threat to life back in Myanmar. Minority Rohingya Muslims have for decades fled to neighboring Bangladesh, but it never endorsed any framework to safeguard the interests of these refugees. Now calls are growing for concrete refugee policy, irrespective of political agenda, faith, or ethnicity.
U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin met with South Korean Minister of Defense Suk Thursday. The two counterparts agreed to develop new operational plans to deal with what Austin described as North Korea's destabilizing behavior.
The United States and the ROK remain committed to a diplomatic approach to the DPRK, and we continue to call upon the DPRK to engage in dialogue. But we also discuss measures to enhance our combined deterrence posture and to defend against the full range of threats.
Missile and nuclear programs. South Korea wants to see sanctions suspended and an official declaration to end the Korean War, two items apparently not near the top of the military chief's agenda. Meanwhile, outside South Korea's Ministry of National Defense, activists called for Seoul to disentangle itself from an alliance with the U.S. and take control of its own national defense.
South Korean armed forces and military resources are likely to be dragged into U.S. Indo-Pacific strategies. We came here to denounce it and to deliver this message to the American authorities. The U.S. should return wartime operational control immediately.
Austin also called out China over its military buildup, as Washington now plans to move more forces, an attack helicopter squadron, and an artillery division headquarters to be stationed in South Korea. The meeting here between the leaders of the U.S. and the South Korean militaries comes following the release of the Pentagon's 2021 Global Posture Review. The U.S. will now place even more emphasis on deterring China and North Korea, with Washington calling for more help from its allies. Frank Smith, Seoul.
In draft documents presented to the signatories of the nuclear agreement, Iran is calling for the removal of all U.S. sanctions that violate the deal signed in 2015, known officially as the JCPOA. Iranian Deputy Foreign Minister and lead negotiator Ali Bagheri-Kani says the Iranian draft includes calls for the removal of all sanctions, especially those imposed under former President Donald Trump, as part of the U.S. maximum pressure campaign.
One of the fundamental issues is that no sanctions that violate the agreements, including those imposed under the Obama, Trump, or Biden administrations, should stay. They're not acceptable. Some of this hadn't been considered in the previous draft. We've included our modifications.
Iran has called for the verifiable removal of sanctions and guarantees that the U.S. will not commit further violations. Tehran says the ball is now in the U.S. court.
I think this is beginning to sink in for the Europeans and the Americans, that this administration, the Iranian administration, will abide by the JCPOA, but it will not allow the Americans to get additional concessions. It will not allow the Europeans to get additional concessions. Iran did not appease Trump. It's not going to appease Biden.
Following talks with EU coordinator Enrique Mora on Thursday, Bagheri also met the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Rafael Mariano Grossi, expressing Iran's intention to continue its close cooperation with the agency and to remain actively engaged in the Vienna talks.
Iran's lead negotiator says he's warned other participants not to allow outside players to negatively influence or obstruct the process of talks, saying his team is serious about reaching an agreement and is ready to continue negotiations. Homa Lezgi, Vienna.
As Yemenis celebrate Independence Day, the Aden Youth Movement called for an uprising against the presence of the Saudi-led coalition's forces and those affiliated with the Hadi regime in the occupied city in southern Yemen.
There is a growing public call for the withdrawal of the invaders from the southern governance, because their presence has deteriorated the ordinary people's living condition and the invaders are in full control of the country's oil and mineral wealth. Today, an awakening movement is coming into force, which is against the foreign presence. The movement reminds us of what our ancestors did when they expelled the British occupiers from southern Yemen in 1967.
The movement denounced the deteriorating living condition caused by the continued collapse of the local currency. The U.S. dollar's price has exceeded 1,600 rials in the occupied areas, compared to 600 rials in the liberated ones.
The public call for foreign forces withdrawal is completely legitimate because their presence has already led to the current deteriorating condition. It goes without saying that the U.S. and the Saudi-led coalition are the ones who bear the responsibility for these repercussions.
The devaluation of the local currency in the areas controlled by the Saudi-led coalition's forces has led to a surge in the prices of basic commodities such as food and medicine. This has hampered daily life for people who are suffering from long years of war.
The depreciation of the local currency and the widespread poverty within the occupied southern areas has contributed to the growing public calls for the foreign forces withdrawal. People here in liberated areas believe that an armed struggle against the invaders is the only way out of the tragic situation in southern regions. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
As more cases of the Omicron variant of COVID-19 are detected in Europe, questions mount over its true origin, how contagious it is, and of course the health threat. The matter was debated in the European Parliament on Tuesday.
The thing that's really on everybody's mind is the new variant.
The head of the European Medicines Agency, Eimear Cook, told lawmakers that greater efforts are needed to get more people vaccinated in the EU.
Especially in those member states where the rates are dangerously low. And this is particularly important as we learn more about Omicron.
Even though we know little about the new variant, EU countries are increasing restrictions. Most legislators agree that vaccination rollout remains key.
We were all a bit late in preparing the booster, and it is the biggest problem is, of course, that people don't get the first and second dose.
Citizens have been reacting to the latest developments.
With this new variant, well, I don't know. I mean, the economy is not actually quite strong, I would say, so whether we really balance, like, health, you know, and survival.
From the stock exchange's reaction, it may have a negative impact on our lives again in terms of economy.
One quarter of adults in the EU have still not been jabbed. A contributing factor to hesitancy, it has been suggested, is the refusal of pharmaceutical giants to release vaccine clinical trial data.
This is not just an issue of taxpayers' fund, but also an issue of trust. Trust in the European institution can be built by transparency.
Many EU legislators are saying it's imperative that Omicron serves as a warning. They are again repeating a message they've been trying to send to political leaders now for almost a year. The West must stop hoarding vaccines from poorer nations, otherwise more variants and perhaps more deadly variants will be coming. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
Activists want U.S. War Secretary Lloyd Austin to open new investigations of past airstrikes, apologize for civilian deaths, and compensate relatives. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Nick Terse, journalist. This article is published under the heading Human Rights Groups Call on Pentagon to Reinvestigate Civilian Deaths in Yemen. Stay tuned for more. Pentagon spokesperson John Kirby said recently, "No military in the world works as hard as we do to avoid civilian casualties." Experts say that it isn't true. "There was a time I could have said that," Larry Lewis, who spent a decade analyzing military operations for the U.S. government under Presidents Barack Obama and Donald Trump, told Intercept. "But that's not what I'm seeing of late. Civilian protection is not prioritized. We are not the best because we are choosing not to be the best." The hard sell from the Pentagon comes in the wake of a New York Times investigation of a 2019 airstrike in Baghouz, Syria, that killed up to 64 non-combatants and was obscured through a multi-layered cover-up. It also follows intense media coverage of an August drone strike in Kabul, Afghanistan, that the Pentagon initially insisted that it was a righteous strike before admitting that it killed 10 civilians, 7 of them children. Revelations about these attacks have raised calls for increased scrutiny of the U.S. military strikes. Recently, the Yemen-based group Mautana for Human Rights and Columbia Law School Human Rights Clinic asked Secretary of War Lloyd Austin to open new investigations of past U.S. attacks in Yemen, apologize for the deaths of civilians whom the United States has already acknowledged killing, and provide compensation to their families. "The department should do more to show it takes the prospect of accountability for civilian deaths and injuries with the seriousness it deserves," wrote Radia Al-Mutawakkil, the chair of Mautana, and Priyanka Motaparty of Colombia, in a letter sent to Austin and shared exclusively with Intercept. The recent New York Times report on civilian deaths in Baghouz, Syria, indicates serious gaps in how the department has ensured accountability. "These events have raised serious concerns that there may be significant shortcomings in how the military responded to reports of civilian harm from Yemen as well." A report by Mautana released earlier this year examined 12 U.S. attacks in Yemen, 10 of them so-called counterterrorism airstrikes, between January 2017 and January 2019. The authors found that at least 38 Yemeni civilians, including 19 men, 6 women and 13 children were killed and 7 others injured in the attacks. A June Pentagon report on civilian casualties acknowledged one of those incidents, the death of a civilian in Al Bayza, Yemen, on January 22, 2019. Mautana investigation found that the attack killed Saleh Ahmed Muhammad Al-Ghisi, a 67-year-old farmer who locals said had no terrorist affiliations. The United States of America had previously acknowledged 4 to 12 civilian deaths in another incident chronicled by Mautana, a raid by Navy SEALs on January 29, 2017, that was first exposed by The Intercept. Both Mautana and Intercept reported a higher death toll. Regarding the remaining allegations, Central Command, which oversees U.S. military operations in the West Asia region, told Mautana in an April 2021 letter, U.S. CENTCOM is confident that each airstrike hits its intended allied targets and nothing else. But the Pentagon gives short shrift to investigations of civilian harm. Mautana's 156-page analysis of the 12 incidents was based on 4 years of investigation, often including site visits soon after attacks by researchers who conducted nearly 70 interviews. It also drew on government documents, medical records, photographs, and videos. In 2017, however, there were reportedly just 2 full-time staff members at CENTCOM responsible for assessing reports of civilian harm caused by U.S. strikes in Yemen, Syria, and Iraq. A 2020 analysis of 228 U.S. military investigations of civilian casualty incidents found that site inspections were carried out in just 16% of those investigations. The U.S. military continues to refuse to conduct investigations of civilian harm where it can, and it never talks to victims and witnesses, said Mark Garosco, once the chief of high-value targeting at a Pentagon and now the military advisor for PAX, a Dutch civilian protection organization. In their letter to Austin, Al-Mutawakkil and Mataparty pointed out that investigations by news outlets disproved initial reports that the August strike in Kabul killed only Daesh targets. Only after a subsequent review of these detailed facts from the ground did the Department of War acknowledge its error, they wrote. Similarly, we believe there is a need to open new investigations into the civilian harm reports we provided based on Mataparty's detailed investigations in Yemen. Exposés by journalists and NGOs have routinely been necessary to push the Department of War to investigate attacks and admit to killing civilians. For example, CENTCOM reported that between August 2014 and March 2017, at least 352 civilians were killed in U.S. attacks in Iraq and Syria. But a 2017 investigation by journalists Azmat Khan and Anand Gopal of nearly 150 U.S.-led coalition airstrikes targeting Daesh in Iraq found that 1 in 5 of the coalition strikes resulted in civilian death, a rate more than 31 times that acknowledged by the coalition. A 2019 investigation by Amnesty International and Air Wars, a UK-based airstrike monitoring group, revealed that while U.S.-led forces took responsibility for 159 civilian deaths in Raqqa, Syria, more than 1,600 civilians were actually killed in air and artillery strikes. The U.S. now acknowledges that 1,417 civilians were slain in U.S. attacks in Iraq and Syria. As the war in Syria came to a close in March 2019, U.S. aircraft dropped 3 bombs on a field in Baghouz, where women, children, and possibly a small number of Daesh were sheltering, leading to a death toll that an Air Force lawyer in charge of determining the legality of strikes, Lieutenant Colonel Dean W. Corsack, called shockingly high. The military had determined in 2019 that at least 4 civilians were slain in Babel's strike, but those deaths did not appear in the Pentagon's 2019, 2020, or 2021 civilian casualty reports to Congress. CENTCOM only admitted that civilians had been killed after the Times contacted the command with its findings. In an email Corsack shared with the Senate Armed Services Committee, a major with the Air Force Office of Special Investigation said that agents generally looked into civilian casualty reports only when there was a potential for high media attention, concern with outcry from local community, government, and concern sensitive images may get out. The circumstances surrounding the Babel's attack offer additional reasons for skepticism of U.S. claims about civilian casualties. While the death toll was almost immediately apparent and Corsack flagged it as a possible war crime, the Times reported, at nearly every step, the military made moves that concealed the catastrophic strike. The death toll was downplayed, reports were delayed, sanitized, and classified. United States-led coalition forces bulldozed the blast site. Recently, Austin ordered a high-level inquiry into the strike and earlier investigations of it. Lewis, who authored the 2013 report Reducing and Mitigating Civilian Casualties, Enduring Lessons for the Joint Chiefs of Staff, says it's imperative for the Pentagon to create an independent review process for civilian harm. It's feasible because I've done it in Afghanistan, he told The Intercept, adding, you need to know that someone is looking at your homework. If not, it's easy to give it a half effort, or worse. And this is what we saw in Iraq and Syria. We saw the same thing later in Afghanistan and Somalia, and in Yemen too. CENTCOM has never considered a civilian death or injury from its actions in Yemen without earlier a journalist or NGO having already extensively reported on the case, said Chris Woods, the director of Air Wars. Its admissions only follow the reports of death by The Intercept and Matwana and an Air Wars investigation of a strike that the Pentagon later said wounded 2 civilians.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, how long does it take for members of the so-called international community to forget about a ruler ordering the murder of a journalist, a crime which was so blatant that it took place in a consulate in a foreign country, and the murderers cut the journalist into pieces and discarded the remains? It appears 3 years is enough time for French President Emmanuel Macron to forget what happened to Saudi dissident and journalist Jamal Khashoggi in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. And according to the CIA, he was killed by henchmen on the direct orders of Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, MBS, the man Macron is in Saudi Arabia to see. What does it all mean? Stay with us as we take a look at this on the Spotlight.
French President Emmanuel Macron met with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman in the Saudi city of Jeddah and discussed a whole range of issues, including crisis in Lebanon, which has been suffering from economic hardships for the past several years. Macron's visit to Saudi Arabia is overshadowed by the 2018 assassination of Saudi critic and journalist Jamal Khashoggi. American intelligence agencies have concluded that the murder was directly ordered by Mohammed bin Salman, or MBS. The visit has drawn reactions from human rights groups. They accused the French president of trying to, quote, rehabilitate MBS. Critics argue that nothing can justify Macron's trip given Saudi Arabia's human rights violations.
Whatever strategic interest France has in Saudi Arabia, nothing can justify their legitimization of a ruler who kills journalists, threatens activists, imprisons women human rights defenders, slaughters Yemeni civilians, and deceives the international community. Macron diminishes himself and his country as he stoops to partnership with MBS.
Macron has rejected the accusations, claiming that the dialogue with Saudi Arabia was necessary to work for stability in the region. The visit is part of the two-day tour to the Persian Gulf that earlier took Macron to the UAE and Qatar. In the UAE, he signed a record $15.8 billion contract for selling 80 French Rafale warplanes. Rights bodies again came out vocal about the sale. They criticized the agreement, blaming the Emiratis for playing a prominent role in the Saudi-led war on Yemen. Signing a major weapons deal with a country involved in the war on Yemen raises speculations as to what exactly Paris is looking for in such trips. Such a sale is especially under the spotlight at a time when France has been deprived of a share in a lucrative security pact among Australia, the UK, and the US. That, along with the fact that France is one of the largest weapons exported to Saudi Arabia, brings one to the conclusion that France is only after selling its military hardware, despite the war crimes Riyadh has committed and the irreparable loss of hundreds of thousands of civilian lives during the ongoing war on Yemen.
Well, I'd like to welcome my guests to the program, author and former U.S. diplomat Michael Springman out of Washington, D.C. And the director of the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, Zafar Bangash, out of Toronto. Well, thank you both for being with me. I'm going to start this off in Washington. And Michael, what do you make of Macron's visit at this time?
Well, Macron, as one African journalist terms him, the cookie monster, given that his name is similar to the French cookie, Macaron, has delusions of grandeur. He wants to reestablish France as a world power. And he has pressured the Lebanese government to have their information minister resign after he had dared to criticize the Saudi war in Yemen. I think that Macron wants to sell more weapons, just like the British and the French do to the region. And there's certainly far too many weapons there now. And he wants to make up, as your commentator said earlier, for the loss of the a submarine contract with Australia. I think that Macron is tied up with some rather unsavory characters like Mohammed bin Salman, who is, as your commentator said, is a essentially a repulsive and repressive despot who doesn't flinch at murder, at capturing people who are dissidents from other countries and jailing them. So I think that Macron should stay home and keep his mouth shut and work to get the foreign soldiers out of the region like the Americans and other countries.
Well, Zafar, do you think that with his visit, Macron is basically giving a nod to his Western counterparts that the minor reprimand of not visiting Saudi Arabia via official delegations is now over?
Yes, absolutely. Unfortunately, most Western governments do not really care about human rights. Their overriding concern is to promote their economic interests, and in particular, weapons sales to a region that is already awash with billions of dollars worth of weapons that are being used against innocent people, we know both Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates have been involved in this brutal war against Yemen since March of 2015, where, according to the United Nations' own estimates, several hundred thousand people have been killed. Also, Saudi Arabia is involved in destabilizing Lebanon. It has sent mercenaries into Syria and Iraq. And the UAE also, which is a partner in crime with the Saudis in Yemen, these new weapons that they have purchased, which obviously will be supplied by the year 2027. But it clearly indicates that as far as Macron is concerned and other Western rulers, they don't care about human rights. They basically only are interested in promoting their own interests. And if there is a government that stands up for its own rights, which is perceived as being contrary to the interests of these Western regimes, then of course these Western regimes trot out this argument of human rights. So I'm afraid this latest deal is going to further destabilize the region. It is not going to do anything for the people of the region.
Michael, how do you see it? I mean, is that the overall goal? You heard Zafar just now talk about that he's afraid that it's going to destabilize the region even more. Is that what it's all about? I mean, with these Western governments that claim that they believe in human rights and democracy and spreading it all over, but is it basically to keep these regions, specifically this region, destabilized? We see the unbelievable amount of weapons and military equipment sold in this region for them to basically get higher profit from the region, or your assessment of it all? What is it all about to you?
Well, my assessment is, just like the gentleman from Canada said, that the outside powers in the United States and in Europe let the region destabilize so they can sell them weapons, so that they can ensure that Israel does not have any opposition of any meaningful strength and power, and that they can do as they will. They can offer deals to various government officials to do their bidding, money, visas, their students in Harvard University or someplace else in the United States or Canada or Europe. So the advantage is to keep the pot boiling, to have a reason for being in there, claiming that we need to help stabilize the region. That's why our soldiers, sailors, and Marines are there. And they don't look to the bigger picture of what is being done to Yemen, what is being done to Lebanon, what is being done to Iraq or Syria. They don't see the attacks on Iran. They whine and they complain that the Iranians are not negotiating in good faith in Vienna, even though the Americans...
Well, Michael, isn't that they don't see... Sorry to interrupt you. Is it that they don't see, or is it that they just basically don't care?
They see and they don't care. They see this as a means of emphasizing their ability to posture, to say that, yes, we are all for all this and that and the other thing, but we need to be in there and we need to have close contact with scumbags like Mohammed bin Salman or other creatures in the area, and that it's to their advantage. They look good, they sound good, and nobody questions what's really behind the rhetoric and hot air.
Okay, with Zafar, we look at, of course, Macron was, he not only went to Saudi Arabia, but also Qatar and the UAE. The UAE, he finalized a deal selling 80 fighter jets to this speck of a country, basically, if we want to say. What do you make of this? It's quite unbelievable. It's amazing that the world is not in outrage, like, why would this little country need 80 more fighter jets, and not realizing the importance, the role of this place in destabilizing it even more. I'm saying, why isn't the rest of the world just not in outrage over this?
Well, essentially, much of the world, and when we talk about the world, we are talking essentially about Western powers. It is in their interest not to worry about the destabilizing effects of the policies of their allies. And what happens to the people of the region is something that they don't care about. We also need to keep in mind that the UAE is simply not capable. They do not have the wherewithal to be able to fly these planes. In fact, I can predict right from now that they will probably need to hire foreign pilots, most probably from Pakistan or Jordan or Egypt, to fly these planes for them. And of course, the French would make tons of money by sending their technicians that would supposedly maintain these this hardware that is going to be supplied to the United Arab Emirates. Unfortunately, the United Arab Emirates is punching way above its weight. It's a tiny country, it has a tiny population, and the majority of the population in the UAE is in fact foreigners. They can't even do much of the work themselves. So what we are witnessing is a situation whereby the UAE is being encouraged by these massive weapons purchases to become even more unruly. We know that the UAE has been involved in Libya, it was involved in Syria. It was even accused by Turkey of having its hand in the July 2016 coup. So we see that this tiny country, this speck of a country, is actually punching way above its weight, and it is likely to find some times ahead if it tries to grapple and chew too much, because it won't be able to swallow it. Of course, we also see that the UAE is going headlong with its so-called normalization with the Zionist regime in occupied Palestine. And again, I can foresee that the UAE is going to lose because they're not going to be able to hoodwink the Zionists to benefit the people or the government of the United Arab Emirates.
Michael, your perspective, how much does Zafar said, the Zionist regime play in all of this? On the one hand, we have these Western countries and wanting to make their own profits and keeping it destabilized. But how much is it also trying to keep the area destabilized? One, because it benefits Israel, and two, also, how much does it play into trying to control and pressure the Islamic Republic of Iran?
Well, I think that's entirely correct. The Israelis, the apartheid entity, are deeply involved in trying to split the Arab world, buddying up to the Gulf states, essentially lines on a map, and improving relations with the Saudis, which, of course, is in keeping with the repressive nature of Israel and its efforts to destroy its neighbors repeatedly since its illegitimate creation. The Israelis have been having a fine time selling their spyware around the world, and they've even managed to sell it, to the Ugandans so they could spy on the American embassy there. That's just been a major issue. The Israelis work and dangle carrots of money and investment and travel and trade and things like this to the Arab world to make them forget all about the Palestinians and what's been done to them, and to gain allies and to ensure a monolith opposed to Iran, which is Israel's real enemy besides the United States. As long as they can do this, they're happy, they're making money, they're acquiring information, they are gaining a hand in the operation of the governments of these various countries in the region, So it's all to their benefit that they destabilize the area and make a profit out of it.
Safar, how complicit do you see these Western governments in Saudi and UAE crimes that have taken place? I mean, you talked about a couple of them before, whether we're talking about Syria or we're talking about Libya or we're talking about Yemen. I mean, how complicit are these entities themselves for selling these type of weapons, for supporting, even giving air support sometimes to these regimes in these different countries?
I think the Western complicity is absolutely obvious. Let us begin with reviewing the Saudi-led war on Yemen, which was announced in the Saudi embassy in Washington, D.C. on March 26, 2015. Now, you would think that a country that is going to wage war on another country, they would make that announcement in their own capital city, their own government would be making those decisions, and yet that decision was made from the Saudi embassy in Washington, D.C. So that's a clear indication that the Americans had given the green light to the Saudis and their so-called allies to proceed with that war crime to attack the people of Yemen. And, of course, we know that the Americans provide logistical support to the Saudis. The British are involved. The French are involved. They are basically even selecting targets for the Saudis to bomb. But, of course, the Saudis are so incompetent that they often miss those targets, and instead they have been killing civilians. They have destroyed civilian infrastructure, whether it is hospitals, schools, warehouses where grain is kept, and other facilities. So when we look at the Saudi-led war in Yemen, obviously the Western governments are fully involved and fully complicit. And this extends, of course, all across the region. When we look at Syria, the United States still has its forces in Syria illegally occupying a part of Syria when the Syrian government has not given it permission to station its forces over there. The Americans have been basically supporting Daesh terrorists, and there is ample proof of that, that it was the Americans that created this monstrous group so that it would destabilize these governments, whether it is in Syria or in Iraq. Of course, in Iraq, Daesh has been defeated thanks to the efforts of the Islamic Republic of Iran, and in particular, General Qasem Soleimani, the martyr, who was martyred because he was so successful against these terrorist groups. And even now, the Americans have their forces in Iraq, and although an agreement was signed that these forces would be pulled out by the end of 2021, and yet the Americans are simply going to change their designation and say that, well, now they're not going to be involved in a combat mission, they're only going to be involved in training the Iraqi army, and so they will still continue to stay over there. So in terms of Western complicity, I don't think that there is any doubt. The Western governments are completely complicit in the crimes that are being committed in that region against innocent people. Regrettably, we don't have an international order in which these real war criminals can be brought to justice. And that is why the people are then left with no choice but to rise up and resist these criminal forces, just as it's happening in Yemen, in Syria, in Iraq, etc.
So, Michael, on the one hand, we have what Zafar talks about is the Western complicity. On the other hand, there seems to be this strange competition between these Western countries. It's as if they are so desperate financially, economically, to see who can sell the most at any cost. I mean, the combination just creates total chaos in the region. Your take on this, what can be done?
Well, unfortunately, nothing much can be done because, for example, in the United States, the sales to these countries of various sorts of weapons is really big business. Joe Biden, who campaigned on the basis of, oh, we're opposed to the war in Yemen, is selling $650 million worth of missiles to the Saudi Air Force. So say one thing and do another. And unfortunately, the people themselves in the United States and in Europe simply go along with this. They're more concerned with the virus and who's got which variant of the virus. They are concerned with keeping their jobs or getting a better job. They're people that don't associate with others because they might get the virus and therefore don't have time to read the newspaper if there is, in fact, any news in it. I was in Missoula, Montana for a week, and the local paper, the Missoulian, is basically half sports and half local news on the front page. So there's no real interest, there's no real information coming to anyone outside of what comes from the main news media, which simply parrots the government line. Basically, it comes down to nobody knows anything, nobody wants to do anything, and nobody cares.
And Zafar, Michael talked about the American people. What about the people of the region? Do you see them more and more as separating from their dictatorial rulers, becoming more and more aware of how basically they've been used and played by their regime leaders and sold out to create basically this instability and to steal their natural resources?
Well, there are different categories. For instance, when we look at Yemen, the people of Yemen, of course, have risen up. Similarly, the people of Syria against these foreign aggressors, and to some extent in Iraq. Unfortunately, in regimes like Saudi Arabia and the UAE, people have been led on this hedonistic path. While we speak, for instance, there in Saudi Arabia, there are massive concerts going on in which the people are being moved into this culture of pop music and dance and etc. And in other words, people are being entangled in vulgarity so that the people's attention would be moved away from what the regime is doing. But I'm afraid they would not last too long. I think there are rumblings of revolt, and ultimately these regimes would be consigned to the dustbin of history, as a number of other regimes were 10 years ago. So I think it's just a matter of time before the reality catches up with these regimes and people rise up in a proper way and get rid of these corruptors that are oppressing their own people.
And the reality of time has caught up with us too, and that brings us to the end of this program. I appreciate both of you being with me, author and former U.S. diplomat Michael Springman, out of Washington, D.C., director of Institute of